Fancy a game?
Technically correct.
Forget all that formal crap about coming at me one at a time. I'll take all you bitches on!
With Tyler Bischoff.
His math's way off.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
The next two words out of your mouth aren't see ya, then the third word will be, oh my god, my crotch, you've punched me in the crotch.
Wow, I'm impressed with Jared today. We get some Luda and some Scrubs in the open. Very impressive work there for Technically Correct. On a Thursday morning, we've jettisoned Tyler Bischoff. You know that's the best version of Technically Correct. Adam Candy in for Mr. Bischoff, along with Jared. British Open is underway. I'm sure that's probably about as much as we can offer you for live sporting events at the moment. A couple of Las Vegas ties in there with Charlie Hoffman, with Adam Scott playing as well. Hopefully you've been able to stay up all night long. 11 p.m. was the beginning of the coverage. I dragged myself through till about 1 a.m. and then remembered that I had a radio show to host in the morning.
I went to bed at 7:30 last night.
My God, why?
These last 2 weeks have been rough, man.
I thought it was just the sadness, the depression from Chrissy being gone. It's just the workload.
Yeah,
I see.
It's the workload, and it's the utter, like, I have no idea what I'm, like, I know what I'm doing, but I don't know, like, it's sort of just like, I feel like the Houston Texans GM right now. Like, am I the what
Houston Texans GM,
exactly,
Jared?
Like, like, there's a meeting with Jadeveon Clowney. No one showed up but me. Do I have to talk to him? Because I wasn't prepared for that.
Well,
that's how I
speaking of franchises where no one knows who the GM really is, and we can't decide whether to pay a premier pass rusher, how about the Oakland Raiders?
Good transition,
buddy. Thank you very much. Training camp begins on the 23rd for your Oakland, soon-to-be Las Vegas Raiders. That's when rookies report. Veterans will be in on the 26th. We know that training camps did open yesterday. NFL season is upon us. The gridiron diehards in the crowd love to say things like, we made it! It's here! So yeah, if you're the kind of guy who loves watching a lot of wind sprints and third teamers running around the field, congratulations, you made it to training camp.
I am that guy.
You're the all 22 guy. I know that. I completely understand that. And the Oakland Raiders are ready to go on July 23rd. They'll show you all that action you're looking for, Jared. It's year two of the John Gruden experience. It's year one of the Mike Mayock experience. It could be the last year of the Derek Carr experience. It is the first year of the Antonio Brown experience. It is probably and hopefully the first year of both the Richie Incognito and Vontaze Burfict experiences, which together could be like nuclear fission.
I was just going to comment that this sounds like the worst 70s rock festival I've ever heard of. A lot of experiences.
There are a lot of experiences. It's sort of like the Alan Parsons Project, but played out on a football scale. There are a lot of things that could be variables in the Oakland Raiders situation this year, and we've talked plenty about the fact that John Gruden appears to be building the best football team in the NFL in 2009. Power running, defend the run, all of the things that are going to win you the Super Bowl against Mike Holmgren and Brett Favre. Unfortunately, that is not what John Gruden and Mike Mayock are trying to do here this year. But they have a believer. They have a believer whom I respect quite a bit, who I think is one of the best football voices on ESPN in Lewis Riddick. And Lewis Riddick went on First Take this week. Why, I don't know. But went on First Take this week and talked about how he thinks the Oakland Raiders are going to be a sleeper team in the NFL. He still thinks the Chiefs are at the top of the division. I think we all agree the Chiefs are at the top of the AFC West. But he thinks your Oakland Raiders who had the number 4 pick in the draft last year, after winning 4 games, are a sleeper contender in the AFC. We're going to hear a little bit as we go along here about what Lewis Riddick said, and we're going to do this sort of breakdown style. As Lewis Riddick talks, we're going to break down a little bit of what he thinks about the Raiders' offseason and why I have some questions about his questions.
What are your expectations for Oakland this year?
Yeah, I expect Oakland to be one of those teams that's going to surprise a lot of people.
Okay. I think we have to define surprise, first of all. Is it surprise that they're going to be a successful playoff contender? Or is it surprise that they somehow could be worse than last year? No, okay. That's just me talking. Lewis Riddick believes they're going to be better. Lewis Riddick believes they might even double their win total this year. You have to bet on a lot of things going right for the Oakland Raiders for this to be a significantly better team than it was last year. And we'll get into those variables as we go along. But more from Lewis Riddick.
Look, they did everything that they possibly could this past year to improve this football team, both along the offensive and defensive line and as far as the skill position players that they have, so they can be a more traditional power team when they need to, and they can be more explosive scoring points and stopping people from scoring points against them.
I mean, you can't disagree with that. They technically did a lot of stuff. They brought in a lot of pieces.
Here's where we start to get into the philosophical disagreement that I have with Lewis Riddick. He says they brought in pieces along the offensive and defensive lines. Fact. They brought in players at the skill positions. Fact. And if building an NFL roster were a matter of going down at your need positions and checking boxes and saying, we have acquired a player who plays this position, and that was the end of the process, then the Raiders have accomplished that. If it involves asset management with draft picks, if it involves salary cap management, if it involves drafting the best available player at the spot you're drafting, then I think we might have some disagreements here about what the Oakland Raiders chose to do this offseason. John Gruden first stripped this thing down for parts and then built it back like a win-now team, plugging in safe players who are not reputed to have significant upside, especially when you're drafting 3 times in the first round, and 2 of those picks are because you traded away 2 of the 3 foundational pieces that you walked into in Khalil Mack and Amari Cooper. Yes, you were going to have to pay them long-term. That's a whole other issue. More from Lewis.
From a personnel perspective, I mean, Trent Brown signing him to the massive contract that they did to play right tackle for them is something that they needed to do.
Whoa, 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 whoa. I know we're going to get into sort of an old school Bill Clinton, what is the definition of is, but what is the definition of needed when we talk about Trent Brown and the Oakland Raiders? Trent Brown signed this offseason to the richest contract in the history of the NFL for an offensive lineman. And let's not get lost in that, because just because you're paid as the highest paid player at a position doesn't mean you're the best player. It means that market value and market scarcity at the time dictated that you got that contract. But that's not how you're going to judge him. We all know that. You're going to look at him and say, well, this guy's the highest paid offensive lineman in the league. Last year, that was Nate Solder for the New York Giants. He's brought in to play left tackle. He ended up playing a position that was LT. He ended up playing left turnstile. Eli Manning was running for his life, such as Eli Manning can run. Nate Solder was signed from the New England Patriots, and Bill Belichick tends to know when to let a player go. And he basically took a 1-year flyer on Trent Brown, filling in for Isaiah Hunt. And Trent Brown turned that into the biggest contract for an NFL lineman in history. But not to play left tackle, Jared Justice. To play right tackle, where there is only one other player in the NFL making double-figure millions per year to play right tackle, and that's Lane Johnson for the Eagles, and he's a pretty good player.
Oh, no, come on. There's no talent disparity there.
I don't think needed is the word you want there if you're Lewis Riddick, because remember that John Gruden used two of his first three draft picks last year on tackles, on Colton Miller and Brandon Parker.
One of those was because the guy they wanted had already gone, and so they turned to Tom Cable and said, who do you like? And we're fairly certain, this is based on my own reporting, my own sources, Tom Cable just picked a name.
Dante Scarnecchia is the offensive line coach for the New England Patriots. Tom Cable is the offensive line coach for the Oakland Raiders. Do you trust that Tom Cable will get out of Trent Brown what Dante Scarnecchia, a Hall of Fame level coach, got out of him? Okay, that's Trent Brown.
Drafting Josh Jacobs to play running back for them from Alabama is something that they need to do. They have that guy now. They have that guy they can control the ground game with.
Again, needed. They needed to draft Josh Jacobs. I don't actually have a problem with drafting Josh Jacobs. 24 is not a bad spot to draft a running back who was well known as the top running back in the class. But John Gruden drafted a ground and pound running back. He did not draft a pass catching running back. He did not draft the kind of running back that is utilized in today's pass heavy schemes. He drafted his 2009 running back. He's not Mike Allstott. He's a little handsier than that. But Josh Jacobs is known as a possession running back. He is known as a guy who's going to run between the tackles and get a few yards. And if that's what you think you need, you know football a lot better than I do. Louis Riddick knows football a lot better than I do. John Gruden and Mike Mayock know football a lot better than I do. But I look around at the other 31 teams in the league and say, what do they know that you don't? Because they seem to be building their teams significantly differently. I don't need to understand what the most popular item in the store is for me. I can watch and look at what everyone else is doing and say, they seem to think that one's pretty good. I'm not sure I myself am the one to tell you it's here to be done differently.
You know, trading for Antonio Brown was a necessity. Now you have one of the best wide receivers in the National Football League.
It was a necessity because you made it a necessity. Had you kept Amari Cooper, it would not be a necessity.
So here's the debate. Do you want Antonio Brown or Amari Cooper and a first-round draft pick? Do you want to trade away a 3 and a 5 with Antonio Brown and extend him at age 31? So here's your question, Raiders fans. Are you happy with that trade-off? I can defend that. I can defend Antonio Brown at the cost of a 3 and a 5. But the need that Louis Riddick talks about, and we keep coming back to this, you need this. Did you need Trent Brown? No. You had two rookie tackles that you decided were good enough to go with last year. You moved Donald Penn off left tackle coming off an injury. Put him at right tackle where you knew he was going to have trouble playing. And he did, and got injured and missed most of the year. And we thought you were bringing in Trent Brown to push Colton Miller to right tackle. No, you weren't. Did you need a running back in the first round at pick 24? Not necessarily. Did you need to trade for Antonio Brown? Only because you dealt away Amari Cooper. Now, Amari Cooper's production had fallen, and no one is going to question that Antonio Brown is a far better receiver than Amari Cooper. But when you start to look at the production of what Amari Cooper did in Dallas once he was integrated back into the offense, once he had a quarterback who was not afraid to stand in, and that, I'm not telling you that Derek Carr and Dak Prescott are the same guy. I am going to tell you Dak Prescott will stand in. And Amari Cooper needs the quarterback to stand in and give him some time to break free. He's not that guy who's always free straight off the line. Okay, so need is an interesting question. You can defend the Antonio Brown trade. He's going to make this team better. He's 31 years old. Amari Cooper was still on his rookie contract and had to be paid. Do you want to pay Antonio Brown roughly $17 million a year? Do you want to pay Amari Cooper $15 million a year and get a first-round pick? Okay, in the long game, I can defend that one.
And in the draft, they needed to address pass rush. They draft Cleveland Ferrell out of out of Clemson. They draft Max Crosby out of Eastern Michigan. So, I mean, they have two guys now, two young guys that they can bring into the fold. They draft Trayvon Mullen at corner, so now they have some more speed in the back end. They draft Jonathan Abrams out of Mississippi State. I can go on and on and on. These are good young players. Now...
Okay. If you draft them in the first round, I hope they're good young players. Max Crosby, Trayvon Mullen, of course, these are later draft picks that we're talking about for the Raiders, third and fourth round picks. But when we say the Raiders had a need at pass rush, look, it was this time last year that I sat here with Tyler and said, do not trade Khalil Mack.
You made the montage. You made the montage.
And I did. And they did trade Khalil Mack. So now you, quote, have a need at pass rush. You chose to sink roughly the same amount of money, about $16-ish million a year, to Trent Brown and Antonio Brown. They have become the second and third highest paid players on your roster. But you didn't want to pay Khalil Mack. You were going to have to pay him more per year than that. But you invested in a tackle who's shown you 1 year and a 31-year-old wide receiver, as opposed to the premier edge rusher in the league on his first contract. You invested in Terrell Williams, a speedy receiver. Again, you have now two of the top four cap slots on your team are wide receivers. I think the money would have been better spent, if you have a need for pass rush, on the pass rusher you had in-house, who is known as a generational player.
It's up to John Gruden to go ahead and put this all together. There is no reason why I believe that Oakland can't be at least an 8-8, 9-7 type of football team, if not more. Worst of first turnarounds are something that happen all the time. They play in a tough division. I know I believe it's Kansas City's division to lose without a doubt. I think Kansas City's going to be a Super Bowl contender, if not a Super Bowl participant for the AFC. But Oakland right now, look, there are a lot of expectations out there. It's not hope. People aren't hoping Oakland's going to be good. People expect them to be good, given some of the things that they've done that they're really not getting a lot of credit for.
Both of those things cannot exist together. You cannot say that Oakland has expectations around it and that this could be an 8-8 team. This is not Jeff Fisherland, where 7-9 is something to aspire to. If you truly believe that John Gruden, in year two of a 10-year contract, is supposed to have this team winning, then you don't believe they're going to be 8-8, because 8-8 is not making the playoffs. And with the schedule the Raiders have, with the fact that they're not going to play at home for nearly 2 months in the middle of the season, to say they have expectations and they could finish 8-8 is a problem. In about 25 minutes, we're going to get into that schedule in detail, talk about what it might mean for Derek Carr's future. Right now, though, I have questions. I hope Lewis Riddick has more answers than I do.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com. Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Team Tennis returns to Las Vegas.
Yeah, none of you expected that the first thing in the briefs was going to be about tennis, let alone Team Tennis.
We've been doing reads about it, because obviously we are sponsored. One of our wonderful, wonderful sponsors is Boyd Gaming, who will be hosting the Las Vegas Rollers home events.
So that will be at Orleans Arena. That's not off a read. That's just off the top of my head.
You've lived in the market for a while. You know which arenas go with which companies.
A time or two. I have been around the market longer than I care to share with you all. So what do we think about the idea of team tennis? Because fundamentally, when I think about tennis, I think about what I watched this weekend. And I went on and on Cofield and Company earlier this week about the Djokovic-Federer match and how I think Roger Federer is the most dominant athlete of his generation. I think that men's tennis in general has become second at best, probably a third-tier draw in the U.S., because there hasn't been a great American player in a really long time. So when we repackage tennis in a team format, when we give it some sort of, you're not rooting for a person so much as you're rooting for our team, does it make you any more interested?
I mean, so Tyler and I had this discussion of we don't really care about the individual matches. We want the mixed doubles teams to be as wacky as possible. So we want like Serena Williams and John McEnroe versus someone else and an older player. Like that would get us more interested in tennis, is make it wacky. So we're probably not the key demographic, but the team aspect of it does add a certain element of, I don't have to keep track who the 232nd ranked player in the world is. I don't have to keep track of a 17-year-old out of Australia. Like, I have more fun listening to Frank Harnish tell me about tennis than I do actually watching tennis, because it's that, like, it feels like a trading card game from the 90s that I'm not in on. Like, it'd be like me trying to explain Pokemon to my parents.
I actually would pay to watch you try to explain Pokemon to your parents. I think that could be a very entertaining event for which I would have a rooting interest. I would be rooting for you to succeed in that. Like, I think that it's a worthwhile shot in what Vegas sports market is today. The Vegas sports market of the past, things like this got written off as just another minor league event. But once the Golden Knights arrived, once this really truly became a major league town, Raiders are on the way, etc., etc., I think it's worth giving some of these sports that have a little bit more of a novelty feel to them another look. And they're doing it indoors, thank God, because the first time I heard anything about this, I thought to myself, please, like, I actually might go watch this. Don't make me sit outdoors to do it. That would be absolutely brutal. But I don't know. I think it's interesting. I think it's worth a shot.
Helps to have the button ready. We're a professional group around here. Pacquiao fights this weekend. Thurman? No clue.
This is live. This is actually on the air, Jared. I'm not sure if you're aware as you're working out the pronunciation of Keith Thurman.
Hey, you've done this show, right? Like, you understand that we don't, planning, trying to sound professional, that's for other shows. We are bad if we lean into it.
Lean into it. Manny Pacquiao, he of 61 career victories, will take on Keith Thurman for Thurman's title belt. That's a strange thing to say in a Pacquiao fight. 29-0, 22 knockouts for Keith Thurman. Thurman is a plus 140 underdog at the Westgate. Is a Manny Pacquiao fight still enough of a draw to where if you sat down on your average Saturday night and nothing else to do, and you thought to yourself, do I want to pay $70 for a Pacquiao pay-per-view? Is Manny Pacquiao alone enough of a draw for you to jump in?
No, in the same way that I don't want to watch a Greg Hardy fight. Like, there, I have a moral obligation not to give him money. So, obviously, I wanted to bring this up with you because you have... Obviously, you're a journalist, and I am super not. Sports Illustrated did a piece on Manny Pacquiao and how he overcame things, and there was a section of it, and I sent it to you earlier, where the writer decided to describe Manny's troubles as such. How did he repair the damage done by the inexcusable comments he made about same-sex marriage that drew the ire of gay rights groups and cost him sponsors, including Nike? He kept fighting. Like, that's like we're trying to do the comeback story, or we're trying to do the perseverance story against a bigot? Like, for a bigot? Like, that's... He didn't apologize. He didn't say, I was wrong. He said, I'm going to keep making millions of dollars. Excuse me.
From a journalistic perspective, that's just a forced metaphor and kind of a lazy one, honestly. Oh, he kept fighting because he's a boxer. Got it. That's how he did it. That's vague. It's a generality, and it doesn't really cover the depth of what Manny Pacquiao said that got him in trouble in the first place. I mean, he has comments as a sitting public official in the Philippines. He's commented saying that gay people are worse than animals. He has said that drug dealers should be killed. That's not entirely out of step with the leader of his country at the moment. These are serious, serious things to have out there in the public sphere. And I understand where you're coming from. I'm not saying I share the straight-up opposition to supporting anything Pacquiao, because I was never someone shelling out for the fights in the first place. So it doesn't really affect me in quite the same way. Don't tell me that I'm going to end up boycotting Taco Bell, because I haven't been to Taco Bell in 20 years in the first place. Yeah. So like, it doesn't really affect me in quite that same way, but I see where you're coming from.
And I guess I don't understand why there seems to be a journalistic element now where are we like 3 years away from, if Greg Hardy is making a UFC like title card, journalists are writing this piece of, and he of course had to deal with this horrible crime that he's never apologized for, he's never shown any contrition. Like, Michael Vick went out of his way after he did his time in jail. He raises money for dogs. Tim Hardaway Sr., whenever he made his homophobic comments, he's marched in pride parade since then. Like, there's levels of contrition, and it's like, nah, it's fine. He kept fighting. Like, is that where we are with the current sports journalism?
There's always a temptation as a sports journalist to trade access for, we'll say, precision when it comes to analyzing the subject. And I think with this article in particular, it's a little bit of what happened. There's great access to Manny Pacquiao's camp. The writer gets a look inside the inner sanctum. But often what the subject will try to do is try to get you to take that access and turn it into favorable coverage. And we've lost a little bit of the dividing line on that over the years when it comes to how these subjects are covered. And if the subject in Manny Pacquiao ultimately tweets out, "Thank you for the profile," I don't know that you've done the job of impartial sports journalist in big, big air quotes, right? If you came away from the subject believing he's contrite, he's making up for it, he's, whatever it is, and you want to express that, go for it. But if you believe that he still has things to account for, you probably should make that a little clearer than I think is made clear in this article.
Aviators win in Tacoma.
So the Aviators are 15 games over 500. Kind of nice to have the Oakland A's farm system here.
Yeah.
they seem to be performing quite admirably.
That's not a comment at all on the Mets.
Well, there are so many comments that you can make on the Mets in the first place that I don't think you need to. The Aviators have a beautiful new 10,000-seat ballpark in Summerlin, and the Mets have a single-A facility that caught fire on July 4th. So I think the metaphors are clear without us hammering them home at all, but impressed by the crowds they've gotten all year long for the Aviators? So.
When I've gotten the opportunity to actually go out and cover a game, yes, I've been incredibly impressed. I sometimes find it odd the amount of Golden Knights jerseys I see, which I'm like, that's a little weird. Like, I guess I understand wearing another sport to... I don't, actually. I do not understand I'm wearing my football jersey to the baseball game, I'm wearing my baseball jersey to the football game. That sort of mentality doesn't make sense for me.
What I don't get is wearing a hockey jersey when it's 105 out, but I do get, and that's what I was saying about World Team Tennis, but the Team Tennis at the Orleans, is that the Golden Knights and the tribalism around the Golden Knights has brought this community together, and it's as much a symbol of the Golden Knights themselves as it is of the general sports community in Las Vegas. And what the Knights now symbolize for everyone, I think, is a Vegas market that is all in on sports and that is all in on this revamped Aviators and Las Vegas ballpark and, who knows, maybe even team tennis. We'll find out.
Is this, though, and I think a lot of people have made this point, there are a lot of Golden Knights fans, there are not very many hockey fans in Las Vegas. Is this the continuation of, There are a lot of Aviators fans. Not very many would know very much about baseball. Is it too soon to make that comparison?
Right now, in today's entertainment landscape, that's the ideal fan base. You want that. You want the casual fan who is not necessarily the diehard who's going to show up every time to be at your games. That is the holy grail right now if you're in the sports entertainment business, is to be able to have an appeal that goes beyond whatever is happening on the ice, on the field. You want people who want to be part of the scene. And that's exactly what the Golden Knights have captured. I mean, yeah, you have your hockey diehards. You know, you have your people who are out there because they care who's on the fourth line tonight. You also have the people who are out there because this is the place to see your friends and feel good about something in the community in Vegas.
C&B scene. No.
C&B scene used to be UNLV basketball games back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Now that's become Golden Knights. And so that part, I actually think that's a great thing when it comes to sort of the halo effect that the Golden Knights have created for everyone else.
The Golden Knights grant a wish to Daron Caldwell.
Okay, this was cool.
Yeah.
The Golden Knights getting in on my wish with ESPN for 13-year-old Daron Caldwell, a young man with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I was impressed by how many of the Golden Knights showed up for this. And go ahead, Jared. You have the point you want to make here.
No. I was just going to say, like, as soon as you said you were surprised, I was like, really? Like, I don't think any of this team is so jaded at this point that they're like, wait, what is it? Do I get paid?
No, it's not that at all. It's more that it's the off season. Guys are with their families. They're traveling. They're doing different things. Yeah, a lot of the Golden Knights have chosen to make their home here in the off season as well. So that makes it a little better chance that you're going to get everybody out. But I think it just goes to underscore the idea that Bill Foley and George McPhee have talked about, that they want guys who are going to be committed not only to the hockey team, but to the community as well. Good on the Golden Knights.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. Want the easiest way to bet on sports in Las Vegas? Download the Be Connected Sports app for free from the Apple or Google Play stores. Then head to your favorite Boyd location like the Orleans, Gold Coast, or Sun Coast to create an account. And with just a $100 deposit, you'll get a free $50 to wager. Then you'll be able to bet before or during the games you love to watch. Plus, if you use Pay Near Me, depositing money into your account can be done at 7-Elevens, Family Dollar Stores, or CVS Pharmacies. It's the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
How are you doing? It's Ryan Reeves. We're here at City Council. Very excited to bring 75 Brewing to the city of Las Vegas downtown. New city that I call home, so very excited about this opportunity.
So we drink and we drink and we drink some more.
Technically Correct on a Thursday morning. Tyler Bischoff is roaming the world. We're not sure where, but the most important thing about it, it's not that he's safe. It's that we just don't care where he is.
He'll be fine.
He's got people watching out for him. Adam Candy in, Jared Justice on the board, and Ryan Reeves into downtown, smashing into the boards with 7-5 Brewing.
Should he feel this confident about opening a brewery here?
You had questions. I promised answers. And so the story, of course, is that Ryan Reeves is going to locate 7-5 Brewing. Of course, 7-5, his number, 75. Ryan Reeves, the Golden Knights winger, approved for a liquor manufacturing license at 1510 South Main Street in downtown Las Vegas. Going to be joining a fairly crowded market when it comes to local breweries.
Yeah.
And not really what we know Ryan Reeves for. He released a beer during the season.
The reviews were mixed.
What were your reviews?
Oh, I haven't tried it. I only drink for free.
I only drink for free. So apparently what you didn't know is that Jared Justice is an Instagram model.
No, I just so Ed Graney of the Press Box, his review of Ryan Reeves' beer was basically, kid, you may need to focus on hockey more.
That would be a very mixed review. of the beer. You asked me, is it a good idea to do that right now? Quick detour here, sports fans, into the craft beer scene. Ultimately, it's a crowded field right now in Las Vegas when it comes to opening a brewery. It's a crowded field throughout the United States if you're going to try to get in on the craft brewing boom, which you probably wanted to open 5 to 10 years ago to really be on the leading edge of. But you are dealing with a number of breweries that I'm not here to throw out plugs for a bunch of them and then forget a handful of names that people will be upset at me about. I've had a drink at most of them along the way. There's a fair amount of innovation and pretty good quality going on for Las Vegas in terms of putting in a brewery. So if you're going to do it, I would like to be an athlete on a multi-million dollar contract who has a little bit of cash to burn in the initial operating expenses so that I can survive the inevitable challenges in getting my initial distribution up to scale, because you're not going to make money when this all starts. But he's got a brand. He's got something to distinguish him. He's got the folks with Abel Baker who have developed a pretty decent little name in the Las Vegas and Reno markets for some of their beers to brew with. So, got some advantages. I'm not sure I myself want to open a brewery right now because it's kind of hard to make money in that business at the moment. But he's got the money to burn, so to speak, to invest in a business. And the comments he made with the city council yesterday certainly makes it sound like Ryan Reeves is interested in getting in on this. He says, this company is not a celebrity endorsement. While it is about me, it's also about the great people of Las Vegas. I've only been here for 2 years, and I've realized that the city has so much culture and so many stories to tell, and through our branding and marketing, we plan on telling a lot of those stories. All right, I'll be curious about that. I'm not sure how you tell the stories of the people of Las Vegas through a beer, but you have the time and money to try to do that and convince us of that. So it's an interesting time business-wise for not only we talk about alcohol, but we talk about for sports in Las Vegas in general, because the Golden Knights have turned this thing into a much different animal than it used to be. And while the Golden Knights were ramping up, we saw different college basketball conferences ready to take their shot in Las Vegas, and it's turned out to be pretty darn good, both for Vegas and for the conferences. The WAC, the West Coast Conference, the Pac-12, and obviously the Mountain West has been here for a while, and we found out this week that the Mountain West has extended for another 3 seasons at the Thomas and Mack Center. We've pretty much gotten used to that now, right? Like, the Thomas and Mack Center feels like home for the Mountain West. We've seen some other movement with the
Pac-12. Feels like home for a lot of teams not named UNLV.
Ouch.
I'm just saying that last year's Nevada game at Thomas and Mack definitely felt like, this is UNLV's home court, is it?
Pac-12 moved from MGM over to T-Mobile. MGM Grand always felt like a right-sized arena for me to have the Mountain West, 7,500, 8,000 or so seats. I think that's what you can reasonably expect to fill for the Mountain West year in and year out with where the conference is right now. But with having UNLV, it's a little easier to keep things going where you have them at the Thomas and Mack. We know the Orleans is largely spoken for when it comes to the West Coast and the WAC. It's not like Thomas and Mack is a bad place for it, but think about the championship game this year. It really didn't look all that great in the Thomas and Mack this year.
Yeah, there were definitely some, okay, don't shoot it from that angle. Why are you shooting it from that angle? Why are you showing all the empty seats?
Is this a tournament that, if you didn't know anything else, if you didn't have a media credential, if you just looked at Nevada, San Diego State, New Mexico, Utah State, are you buying a ticket? Are you walking up and buying a ticket if you just live in town?
No.
And I think that's the problem for a lot of people here, is that if UNLV isn't in it, and UNLV obviously has not hung around the tournament very long the last few years, then what do you do to get fans to stick around after their team has been eliminated. Because let's be honest here, there are two fan bases in the Mountain West that travel. Two and only two. New Mexico travels. They call it the Pit West when they're here, right? New Mexico always travels. Wyoming travels. Laramie comes out in force.
I mean, that also might have to do with Laramie. Just like, what are you doing this weekend? We are leaving.
Laramie is windy. It is
cold.
Almost always cold. And when it is not cold, it is windy. And so I've spent enough time in Laramie to be able to
You've been to
weigh
both their restaurants?
Hey. Let me speak up strongly for the library. Nice little brew house in Laramie, Wyoming. That's made a couple of long nights seem a little shorter for me when I've been there with UNLV. But really, those are the two fan bases that travel. We saw Utah State in the championship last year. No, Utah State doesn't travel. I mean, we could run it down if you want to. San Jose State, no. Why are they here? Realistically, why are they here? This is not a team that should still be in this conference. They do not bring anything to the table. San Jose State should not be here. San Diego State, for as good as the program is, just doesn't travel all that well. Not compared to New Mexico, not compared to Wyoming. You need the Lobos to be good. You need Nevada to stay good. Overall, I think it's the right thing for the Mountain West to stay at the Thomas and Mack. But if the opportunity ever came up for the Orleans or MGM Grand, right sizing might be the right move.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
A very big sports story is happening.
Tyler Bischoff is...
If a very big sports story was happening, we'd know it.
We do know it. We just don't understand it.
You don't understand it.
Technically correct.
Help me out, Jared. Was that a sports night cut?
Yes.
Oh, you are speaking all of my languages here today. I knew there was a reason I was in studio. Technically correct. Sponsored by Boyd Gaming here on a Thursday morning. Adam Candy in for the globetrotting Tyler Bischoff. Last time he was in Europe, right?
Yes. He said Italy, and then cryptically the last day before he left, he was like, "Or is it Spain?" And then just like ran away. Like smoke bomb left.
International man of mystery, Tyler Bischoff.
International guy who normally winds up with a sunburn, Tyler Bischoff.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
That skin doesn't tan.
No, my goodness. That man looks like Elmer's glue became a human being. There's no way that he's going to get any sort of a suntan. Like, there's no chance. We started this show off talking about the Oakland Raiders. Training camp opens next week up in Napa. And we heard from Lewis Riddick of ESPN, who said that the Raiders are going to surprise. The Raiders could be an 8-8, 9-7 team. For that to happen, Derek Carr has to have a much better season than he has for the last 2 years. And let's give Derek Carr this. For the first time in 4 years, Derek Carr will be entering the season with the same offensive coordinator that he had the year before. Not easy to have the rug swept out from under you, especially when the new rug is Todd Downing, and then the head coach changes. So Dominique Foxworth on ESPN had some interesting comments about what this season means, not just for the Raiders, but for Derek Carr in specific.
Pretty obvious to me is Derek Carr, and I'm Oakland right now. After this season, it'll only be $5 million in dead money if they cut him. He's playing for his job. He's really the only guy in there who is playing for his job in this situation. Doesn't seem like John Gruden really likes him or wants to keep him there. So he may not even be playing for his job for Oakland. He's playing for his job for someone else. This season may determine whether another team looks at him and thinks he's a
probably
starting
caliber. Probably for Denver.
It may determine whether the other teams consider him a starting caliber quarterback or a backup quarterback. So I think the pressure is on him. You look around the league, Joe Flacco's in his first year and probably towards the end of getting closer to the end of his career, there's not as much pressure. The expectations aren't very high. There's really no pressure on Patrick Mahomes as a player. Like, he's lights out in general. And then Phillip Rivers, he's a Hall of Famer. It's hard to say that there's a lot of pressure on a guy like that.
So the question posed to Dominique Foxworth was, which AFC West quarterback is under the most pressure this year? Okay, that's a pretty obvious answer. Phillip Rivers, Patrick Mahomes, no pressure. unless you want to say Rivers has Father Time chasing him, and that's, you know, a bit of a cliched narrative that we don't need any more of.
I would also say the other pressure with Philip Rivers is which one of my great teammates is going to wind up getting injured, and me just being like, I guess I'm throwing it to this, you know, garbage man who randomly showed up on the team one day.
So you mean Antonio Gates came back again?
Yeah, basically.
Melvin Gordon's going to take care of that early this year by sitting out. So you're not going to have to worry about who you're going to lose. You're going to lose him before the season in the contract holdout. Derek Carr, I have said more than once, is an above-average NFL quarterback, and above-average at the quarterback position should be considered to be close to elite, because elite is even higher when you talk about the replacement value at quarterback. But Derek Carr's numbers from last year don't suggest elite. Yes, he threw for 4,000 yards, 19 touchdowns, 10 interceptions, not a great ratio. He has thrown for declining amounts of touchdowns in each of the past 4 years. Antonio Brown is likely to help change that, but does Derek Carr have the offensive line to let him have time to throw, and does Derek Carr have the trust in his offensive line to keep his feet in the pocket long enough to hit those receivers? So we talk about, are the Raiders going to be 8-8, 9-7, which to me doesn't sound like surprising. That sounds like mediocre. They open at home against the Broncos. Let's go game by game real quick here, Jared. They open home Broncos. I say they're a favorite in that game and a potential victory. Okay. Next week, on a short week, home Chiefs.
Good luck.
Good luck indeed. At Minnesota. I think that will be close to a pick. They follow that with at Indianapolis. That is an underdog game, especially 2 weeks in a row on the road. I'm going to call that a loss. Then you go to London, where you find Khalil Mack, who is going to have 74 sacks in one game just to prove a point. A bye, and then at Green Bay. Not an easy place to win. At Houston. That defensive line is a little scary. Then 3 weeks at home against the Lions, Chargers, Bengals. Realistically, you're going to win two of those three games if everything goes right. At the Jets, at the Chiefs. That could be 0-2, could be 1-1. Titans, Jaguars, Chargers, Broncos. You finish fairly soft. Ultimately, 8-8 is a success with that record. So maybe I agree with Lewis Riddick more than I thought in the first place. Technically correct. Back tomorrow at 10 a.m.
Tell Jared to shut his yap and concentrate on the show.